And that's with Enzo Levin of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, writing in Foreign Policy about the U.S. lessons learned and not learned since the Second War about small wars. Ukraine is a small war. The resupply of weaponry may sustain it through another year, may not. There's a dire shortage of manpower at the front line for Ukraine. There's talk of returning draft-age men from Poland forcibly. Ireland is talking about cutting off what we call transfer payments in the U.S., that is welfare, to Ukrainian refugees. Canada may do the same. There are lots of refugees around the world who are draft-age and not returning to Ukraine. Therefore, is this a good time to talk one more time about making an accommodation? Appeasement is not supposed to please anybody. And it's all, what does Cyprus teach us? So how is that a model?
Well, Cyprus, Kashmir is another, actually Northern Ireland too, indicates that in order to establish, you know, an unsatisfying but reasonable peace, you don't have to resolve territorial issues formally. You can kick them down the road. Nobody, by the way, nobody has ever recognized Indian sovereignty over most of Kashmir. Officially speaking, America is still neutral on that issue. It doesn't condemn it. But the point is that it's been a generation, two generations now, since anyone has actually raised that issue internationally, apart from the Pakistanis, or tried to do anything about it. Same with Cyprus. Nobody recognizes the Turkish Republic of Northern Cyprus, but nobody talks about it anymore. Nobody tries to do anything. My point being that it's absolutely out of the question that the Ukrainians should officially recognize Russian sovereignty over the territories that they've lost, or that we should do so, or that we should urge the Ukrainians to do so. But by the way, this is what Zelensky himself proposed with regard to Crimea and the eastern Donbass at the start of the war. You can defer it for future negotiations, and then gradually, you know, kick it down the road. Maybe at some point in future things will change. So that, I think, is the lesson there.
I chose Cyprus because you mentioned in your foreign policy piece, the puzzle here is who's to lead that discussion. You also point to a piece of diplomatic magic that happened in the middle of the 20th century, I see, the Austrian State Treaty. What does that teach us?
Well, the Austrian State Treaty teaches us that it is possible to preserve democracy in a country while also establishing its neutrality between East and West. That is also the lesson of Finland, by the way. The Austrian State Treaty also included two other things which are of relevance to Ukraine. The first was certain kinds of disarmament, and obviously no basing either of Soviet or of NATO troops in Austria. The other, of course, like in Germany, coming out of the Second World War, was a law against neo-Nazi parties and symbolism. This is what Russia is demanding in the case of Ukraine. And minority rights, guaranteed minority rights. These are all things. Now, Russia's maximalist demands are unacceptable, but some of these things are things that Ukraine should have to do in order to join the European Union at some stage. We ought to be insisting, you know, on rules against neo-Nazi parties and on minority rights, not because Russia is demanding it, but because it's that they're in tune with our own values.
I'm also puzzled here going forward as to whether this conversation is happening. I mean, these are really good models, and if I was a diplomat, I would have learned them in school. So I'm certain they all know them. State Department knows, Foreign Ministry knows in London. Why aren't they bringing forward these ideas? Why have we waited 2 years for resupply of long-range missiles?
Well, I mean, on the supply of missiles, obviously, there is a... Well, Europe is running very short of weapons, unless it completely, you know, strips its own arsenals, which would look a bit odd, given that we're told that Russia is a threat to Europe. In America, of course, it became a partisan issue for 6 months, and that held it up. As far as diplomatic solutions, I think there are two problems, really. Nobody wants to be seen to be agreeing with Russia. But of course, if there is ever to be a peace settlement, then, well, by definition, you have to agree to some Russian points. You know, given that it's now absolutely clear that we're not going to win a complete victory over Russia at some stage, there will have to be a compromise, which means, you know, accepting certain Russian points. And indeed, I mean, the Biden administration has intermittently said that this war will end in a compromise. But the other problem is that you keep hearing that, oh, peace is exclusively a matter for the Ukrainians. Well, there are a number of problems with that. One is that, obviously, it isn't. I mean, if we fund and arm the Ukrainians to such an extent, if we run considerable risks to them, you know, the Europeans have suffered, especially the Germans, considerable damage to their economy. Obviously, we have a say in any peace settlement. Secondly, the problem is that the Ukrainians cannot initiate a peace process. In fact, they passed a law barring any talks with Putin. So obviously we have to start. And there are things, notably neutrality, NATO membership, troop deployments. They are not actually a matter for the Ukrainians, because the question of whether Ukraine is admitted to NATO is not a question for Ukraine. It's a question for NATO and the United States, whether they're accepted. So, we have to take the lead, and at present, nobody is willing to do that. The Biden administration will do nothing until after the elections. After that, we'll have to see.
Anatole Levin of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, writing in Foreign Policy about diplomatic models available right now to Ukraine. I'm John Beck.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.